Go Loud presents Magnified with Matt Cooper, proudly sponsored by Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Move your business forward with a fleet of commercial or passenger vehicles. Build your fleet to your expectations. Visit vwfs.ie/business.
Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Hello and welcome to this, the last episode of our current series of Magnified, our podcast series in which I have lengthy conversations with people from business, entertainment, sport, politics, indeed media as well, about their careers and about the challenges they faced and will be facing. I'm a little bit different today because I've asked Daniel McConnell, the editor of the Business Post, to join us. And I do want to talk a bit about his career as well, but I do also want to talk about the place of newspapers and news organisations in the modern 21st century media environment. Given all that we've been hearing about RTE in recent weeks, what about the place of what we once called the newspapers, but now are maybe a little bit more? So we will be talking about that, and our thanks again to the support from Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Move your business forward with a fleet of BEV electric vehicles. Build your fleet to your expectations. Visit vwfs.ie/business. Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. So that'd be nice, not one of my bosses, Daniel McConnell. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
RTE very much in the news recently, and I do want to get to that and the place of competitors to RTE. But tell us, why are you a journalist?
Very good question. So I remember when I was back in school and we were at the stage of kind of what are we going to put down in our CEO form and all the rest of it, and I hadn't a clue. But I had a really good career guidance teacher. He said, well, what are you interested in? And I said, well, I'm interested in history, politics, and one of my mum's very good friends, Muriel Bulger, was a journalist and had worked in the Irish Press, and we'd gotten to go to a lot of, you know, shows, and she'd gotten us to do book reviews, and she'd sort of given me an insight, and I'd been into the Irish Press newsroom and got to get her photographs taken, so I'd really been captivated by that. We were a weird house because we used to watch Prime Minister's Questions when we were growing up in the UK, and my dad was like very into politics, so like Morning Ireland was always on the radio. We were always a two or three newspaper house, so it was, you know, kind of in me, kind of, and I didn't realise until I was much older that I'm actually a third generation journalist. My dad wrote on economics for the Irish Times back in the 60s and 70s, and his dad wrote for the Express in the UK, going back kind of, you know, previous decades. So at some point it was probably inevitable that I'd end up being a journalist. But why print? I fell in love with newspapers when I was in college. I got involved with the University Observer, and I still to this day remember that sensation of seeing that first byline when it's in the arts block, and seeing like thousands of copies of the paper in circulation, and then you can kind of say you could have an awful lot of fun with it. I've been very lucky. I've had a brilliant career. I've been very lucky in the jobs that I've held. I've worked with the Indo, the Times, the Examiner, and now with the Business Post, you know, and I've done an awful lot. I haven't just written on politics or on business. I've written on, one of the best pieces of advice I got going into the Sunday Times, where I did my first placement out of DCU, was do everything. If they ask you a question, say yes. If it's Christmas Eve, say yes. If it's your girlfriend's birthday, do it. Like, and that sort of, you know, attitude will get you. And it did. In fairness, it was that sort of willingness to kind of, you know,
I know nothing about that, go and find out.
I think having a healthy curiosity about stuff. Again, Angus Fanning, who was my editor in the Sunday Independent, always said, don't ever be afraid to ask a silly question, because there are no silly questions now. Within reason, I think. But don't ever be afraid to ask the obvious question that people, because I often found at press conferences, particularly during the financial crash, we were talking about highly complex matters around bondholders and burning and, you know, kind of really complex stuff. And a lot of stuff was going over the heads of most journalists, but a lot of them were too either snobby or too, I don't know, reluctant to kind of ask the question. And I found myself asking a lot of the stupid questions. And in fairness, that seemed to kind of explain things or helped us explain things. But I still have that endless curiosity. You know, I think I spoke to you before. I think when I did the Culture Club on The Last Word, you know, the buzz previously was getting the front page and getting the story that set the agenda. Now for me, it's empowering with the journalists who work with me and to make the best newspaper and to make the best compelling website every day, you know, and that's the sort of thrill that I get now.
So better than being a rock star or a pilot? Yeah, I chose those two examples.
Yeah, for very good reasons. Like I think I said to you before, again, like the thrill of playing music is a very individual thrill. When you're playing music and writing music with friends and your pals who you've grown up with is a very unique kind of experience. This is a very, journalism can be a very individual thing.
So, no, go back to the music. What was the band and how often did you gig? And
we gigged a lot. Like, so Robbie Fox was our manager. Robbie Fox, you probably remember.
From Reynards, and the Pink Elephant.
So he saw us busking on Grafton Street and he took us in, and we were, what, 16 at the time. So we got exposed to this world of the Dublin music scene, and Robbie's great gift to us, I always say, was giving and opening the doors of Dublin to us. So we would have gigged quite a lot, we would have recorded quite a lot.
What was the name of the band?
The first band was called Lucid, then we found there was another band in Sweden with the same name, so we had to change it to Lucidian, which was a desperately terrible name. But we were very influenced. You might remember it was around the time the OK Computer, the Radiohead album, came out, and we were very influenced by that. So we thought a terrible name is no impediment to success. We were wrong about that. But then, you know,
sorry, what sort of music did you play?
So we were very kind of that indie kind of rock. But again, Ali O'Dwyer, who's one of my best mates and who I played with, we were very much into the likes of Elvis Costello. We would have been, you know, beyond the sort of the Britpop of Oasis and Blur, we would have gotten into the likes of the Smiths, then kind of Costello, as I said. So that we were like, and our that journey through. So there were a lot of bands who were very important to us early on. I, for some reason, managed to get myself into the likes of Sinatra and Dean Martin. So I like
went, oh,
it was around the time that Sinatra died, and I remember there had just been wall to wall coverage around his death and his importance. And I fell in love with the voice, and I fell in love with the idea of, from a rhythm section perspective, about, you know, walking bass lines and this, how, you know, Nelson Riddle, who was the great conductor and orchestrator for Sinatra, about how he just introduced this concept of swing and just, you know, bands really letting loose, and I was just fascinated by that.
So how far did you bring that musical career?
So I came to a point in my early to mid-20s, just after my dad died, and it was a cross point where Ali and I had there was a deal on the table for us. And I had just finished in DCU and I'd done about 5 or 6 months of freelancing out of DCU, primarily with the Sunday Times, and it was kind of...
What sort of deal?
It was a money, like it was big money to record,
to do an album and stuff?
To do albums and stuff. Like, it was a kind of a development deal, as they would have called it. Like, so we were... It was at that point where, and I just, between dad dying and being at home with my younger brother, it was just the two of us, and journalism was really, I was really into it. I hadn't gone to college, hadn't edited the paper, you know, this conflict was kind of there, and I chose the journalism route.
And how did your mate Ali feel about that?
Yeah, he went solo. He's a brilliant singer and he still is. Like, he's an amazing artist in his own right. But I think there was no doubt a disappointment, because we had been very close, you know, in terms of the music thing. You know, there was something in my gut thinking that, like, it was just not too risky, but it was just the journalism was the one I wanted to concentrate on.
And were you singing, or what were you doing?
Yeah, so the two of us both sing. He was primarily the lead singer, but we would have done a lot of harmonies and a lot of songwriting together.
And you were on electric guitar, were you?
I was on bass.
On bass,
yeah.
Okay.
I'm a four-string merchant.
Okay. Very important and underestimated.
Underestimated, yeah. So we, like, not that we considered ourselves to be Lennon and McCartney, yes, but he was very much a guitar player and I was very much a bass player, and, you know, so, but we worked really well. Like, it's still one of my favourite dynamics. Like, I would, even in journalism, consider myself a much better collaborator than working by myself. I love the idea of working on something with somebody. So that, you know, when John Lee and myself wrote the book Hell at the Gates, available in all good bookstores now, like, I loved the idea of collaborating with John. That idea, there was two forces, you know, the combination of two forces coming together was better than the sum of our individual parts. And John was a great collaborator, and we bounced off each other very well. But I've been very lucky. I've worked with some great, you know, partners in journalism throughout my career. So, like Jerome Riley in the Sunday Independent, Liam Collins was another great mentor of mine in the Sunday Independent. And then even in the Examiner, like, being able to work with the likes of, you know, Fiacre O'Kyona, who now is with RT, Elaine Loughlin, who succeeded me as political editor, Ciara Phelan, who I worked with for a short period of time, who's now gone into government. You know, I've been very lucky to work with people and really share that collective spirit. Because I think, you know, when you're able to bounce ideas off somebody, I think it can be, you know, a much more fruitful experience than, say, having to do it by yourself. I've seen journalists who would be very territorial around a scoop or around a line. One of the best things I love about the Business Post is that there's a real collective spirit. So, like, there's a great spirit of colleagues helping each other, sharing bylines, and it's all about serving the story, not necessarily the individual ego or the individual sort of kind of personality. And that's a spirit I've really tried to foster as well.
And then what about being a pilot?
Yeah, that was kind of slightly later kind of thing. I kind of got to a point where I've always been interested in aviation, but I really, I suppose in the last 10 years or so, really took a very strong interest in not only commercial aviation, but civil aviation. And I was nagging my wife. I said, go on, get me a voucher for my Christmas or birthday. And she said, no, I don't want you falling out of the sky type of thing. But eventually got a few lessons, and I got the bug almost immediately.
Why? What is it?
It's just, you leave all your problems and all your worries on the ground, and it's, but the level of discipline that's required to do it and do it well, even in a single engine plane. You know, there's rigorous checklist before you even turn on the engine. There's a rigorous checklist before you even take off. And, you know, there's a level of control and focus. And it was a test. It was totally out of my comfort zone. And I just love it. Absolutely.
How advanced are you now?
I'm still working on my PPL. So I took it, like, I stopped during COVID, really kind of like put an idea. But the goal, and the kids were at an age where, like, what I was doing, I suppose, where I was falling down was, I was doing a lesson, waiting 3 weeks, doing another lesson. And I was getting nowhere, because every time you there's a gap, your muscle memory fades. So basically I got all my the book work done, so it just now I need to finish out my hours, and I think once the kids are grow up a little bit, I'll lash into it.
Could you ever see yourself having a career, a late stage career?
I don't know. I mean, the idea of flipping in from journalism into aviation, like, I would be pretty much pushing the upper limit of what's doable. But there are plenty of stories, like there is a shortfall of pilots internationally.
It's a, you know, brilliant profession to get into, because it's well paid for the work.
Very well. And I think one of the big bonuses now, like, I mean, let me put it this way. There's no better time for me if I was really interested to go in and do it now, because whereas rather than having to pay for your training yourself, airlines are now putting the money on the table. They're funding your training now. The options are, if not in, like, the goal for a lot of people in Ireland would be, you end up either working for Aer Lingus or Ryanair, but there's potential in airlines all over the world, not just in Europe, because there's such a shortfall.
Yeah, because it's interesting that, you know, you've had those options that you could have, and you stuck with what you're doing. And you mentioned one former colleague who's gone to work for government.
Mm.
And this is something that I've noticed more and more over the recent decades. And it's something that people outside of journalism comment on as well, whether it's appropriate for people who are political journalists in particular to actually make the jump to being part of the system that they're supposed to be monitoring and reporting on.
Mm. I think what we've seen, I think that transition from journalism into being a political advisor for a minister has always happened. I just don't think it's ever happened on the scale that it's happening at the moment. I've certainly seen...
It used to be very rare.
Yeah. We're now, and I think it was always big news that if, say, someone jumped the fence, as it's called, but, you know, we have certainly in the lifetime of this government and certainly in the lifetime of the previous government, quite a number of very established, very prominent journalists, the likes of Fia Kelly, Sarah Barden, Niall O'Connor, you know, Jono McEnroe, Michael Brennan from our own parish, you know, have gone in. You know, there's quite a number of journalists who've made that leap across into.
And if you go back, it started in my memory from the likes of Sean Dignan, being the presenter on 6-1 News, becoming government press secretary under Albert Reynolds. You would have had people like John Murray as well, Shane Kenny, various others. So it's not unheard of. John Downing, who came back to the Independent as well.
Mary Minnan, who worked with the Progressive Democrats, is now in the Irish Times on the news desk, I think.
Yeah, so, I mean, it is there, but it's something I've often wondered about. Worried is too strong a word. And I can understand at times, maybe for financial reasons and security, that people might do things and make career choices. But back to the point, is it appropriate for somebody who is there supposed to be rigorously holding government to account as part of their job to then become part of that very system?
Yeah, it's a difficult one, because, I mean, I've had offers to go in and
I was about to ask you that.
I've gone, you know, to go across and either for... You know, I think everyone will have their own individual motivation. I mean, some will go in because they spot a potential leader and they want to see whether or not that goes the way. So Sarah Barden, when she joined Simon Harris, may not have known that he was going to end up as Taoiseach, but maybe have thought, well, this guy is going places. There are others who probably, you know, go in with a minister who may be on their last leg and might just be interesting. Some may have gone in at a time of the financial crash, and it may have just been an interesting, fascinating time to be in government, you know, to be inside rather than reporting on it. I think the money aspect, I think, is probably the big determining factor in a lot of cases. The money, the funding, journalism in terms of journalism salaries is nowhere near where it was or as robust as it was even when I started in journalism. I consider myself probably one of the last generations of that old school kind of decent salary levels. So I would have looked at colleagues when I was turning 30 and even a little beyond. I could see guys coming after me on salaries of half of what I was on, doing not the same job, but you know, kind of early reporter gigs. And that obviously has a seismic impact on the outlook of reporters, what they're going to report on, the quality of people who are likely going to come in, etc. like that. So I do think there has been a fundamental shift within journalism. Like, I mean, in generations before I got into journalism, you know, it was akin to the civil service. I remember when I was in the Independent, like, you know, your expenses were paid at civil service rates. Like, you know, there were rates and bands put in that were essentially equivalent to the civil service. That's how rock solid a gig was, or how prestigious a staff job in journalism was.
So why did you not jump over to the other side?
I wasn't ready for it. For right or for wrong, and this is something my missus often kills me about, you know, would you not leave journalism, go off and make some real money? I just love it. And it's the kind of thing I think, you know, life is short enough that you can't do something you don't love. And I really love what I do. I think I really value the importance of journalism. I'm an old school newspaper hack. I believe in trying to get it right. But that goal is trying to get that scoop that nobody else will have, to set the agenda. And I think for all the ills and for all the problems and difficulties facing print journalism, it still sets the agenda in Ireland. And I still think all the radio shows will still take their lead primarily from what happens in newspapers.
Well, that brings me to one of the main reasons why I asked you to come in here, because that is something that has very much struck me in the conversations we've had over the last year, but which have intensified in the last week, about the role of RT as a public service or public sector broadcaster and its need for finances from the state to fulfil its remit, because it almost comes to a sort of an implication that nobody else can do it like RT does. And yet, as you've just said, how often is RT following an agenda set down by a newspaper? And what does RT do if it still survives but finds there are no newspapers or news websites there which gives it its ideas?
Yeah, I don't think there's very few people, I think, in this country who would advocate for the closing down of RT. A lot of people will value the public service remit. It does a very good job of what it, you know, in terms of the journalism that it does, the quality of journalists that it has in its within its stable. But I think the RT model of trying to be omnipresent in every aspect, in entertainment, in sport, in news and current affairs, is that sustainable or viable in such a fractured media market? At a time, I suppose, when you're looking at how advertising has gone, I mean, the advertising market in Ireland was about 1.4 billion in 2023. Newspapers and print accounted for less than 100 million of that. Like, I mean, the numbers have condensed and been squeezed,
collapsed.
And that's largely because of the impact of the online, the tech companies who are hoovering up a huge amount of that advertising market.
And who are not responsible for the content piggyback on.
No.
They're parasites.
Absolutely. The other thing is RT has suffered a huge fall in its own commercial revenue, but has always benefited from this dual funding model. It's had the licence fee and has also been able to advertise.
So it's a triple funding model, because it's not just the licence fee and the commercial revenues. It's regular top-ups going back decades from RT, government.
Yeah, I was going to make that point. And that raises a whole series of questions of whether is it appropriate for government to be funding RT in the manner in which it has been doing so, at the expense of an independent sector, which I think, all things being equal, could succeed and could thrive. I thought the point made by Virgin Media last week was absolutely spot on. This is a company, yes, a commercial entity that makes money and normally would make money and give dividends to its shareholders, but serves a very clear public service function. And it competes with RT in terms of viewership and in terms of its output. But you look at it, it has estimated it need about 25 to 30 million to essentially do its news, you know, its news and current affairs, and was looking for government funding to help it with that.
I just suspect on that it probably wouldn't be looking for government funding unless it wasn't for the fact that its main competitor has government funding.
But that's the point I'm making, in terms of that it's not a level playing pitch.
Yeah.
One of my big gripes as the editor of the Business Post is that we have a website, we're trying to charge subscribers and we're trying to attract as many subscribers as we can to view our content. But at the same time, you have free websites like the RT website, which can either take our stuff lock, stock and barrel and repurpose it, or can compete with us. But we don't get any core funding from government. We do, and I'll declare this, we have taken €100,000 from the Global Media Fund, which allows us to fund some of our operations in Brussels and in London, but it's not core funding. It's not our day keeping the lights on kind of money. And RT has always obtained and retained this dominant position in the marketplace. It is by far, you know, it's number one across all the metrics. You look at the top 20 list, Matt, you know, in terms of radio shows, it's RT, large, and there's a couple of very rare exceptions on that. And you wonder, and you ask from an independent broadcaster perspective, is that fair? Is that equitable? And I think, you know, I think the position that Catherine Martin and government have arrived at, I don't think is either satisfactory from that perspective. I think all it does is kick the can down the road. I don't think it has solved the long-term funding problem for RTE. But also as well, I think what it has done is just reinforced that inequity within the market. I remember when the Future Commission media report was published and they did a press conference in the courtyard of Dublin Castle, and Breen McGrath, who was the chair of that. And I asked him the very pointed question, is this not overly RTE-centric? And he assured, oh, no, there's money for court reporting in local papers. But that's minuscule in the overall scheme of things. So I think what we have done here, I think we reinforce what government has done is reinforce that inequity within the market. I think RTE needs to really come and have a come to Jesus moment as to what it really stands for. I don't think what we've seen to date so far is radical enough to repurpose what RTE could be and what it should be in an open and free market.
Yeah, just on that, I think the example I've been using is, can you imagine if you'd gone back 30 years ago before the advent of the internet, when the newspapers were so big in the media environment and would have been competing with the broadcasters for advertising revenue, if RT had used this license fee revenue and commercial revenue at that time to launch its own newspaper, it would have been stopped. Government would have moved in and said, you can't do that. That would be anti-competitive. And then what it did was it launched its website at a time when the internet became the thing, when the newspapers were struggling financially and didn't have government resources or state-supported resources to do so. This allowed RT to get the jump to make that digital transformation.
Yeah, and I think also when the newspaper industry has to hold its hands up, I mean, there was a fundamental error in hindsight, I think, from newspapers at the start to give away their content for free as they were when the internet became a thing. And I remember, now I always remember, like, early iterations of online desks, they were always an adjunct or a kind of a subset of the news desk. They were kind of almost in their own little operation away from the main operation because they were seen as, we don't want to have anything to do with you. You look at newspapers and newsrooms now, online desk and the main news desk will sit side by side, or they all have been integrated into one, because we all realise that digital is our future and it has to be central to operations. But I do think we have to be open and honest with ourselves that was a colossal mistake, because it forced people at that time, or allowed people to get used to the idea of getting content for free. I think that is changing. I think we are now much more used to subscription models. I think the idea of subscribing for Netflix and the Irish Times to the Business Post or whatever like that, I think is now an accepted model. What we just need to do is make sure that our growth in digital subscriptions either matches or outpaces the decline in what we're seeing in print. And that's the challenge that me and other editors are facing on a daily basis.
Rupert Murdoch, possibly the most famous newspaper man in the world, who is now well into his 90s and is in the middle of this wonderful succession-style battle with his children.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
Which is absolutely great stuff. It's one of the most fascinating lives that has been lived in media. But he recently gave an interview in which he said newspapers would no longer exist in 15 years, to which there was a couple of responses. I thought one was that long. He gives it that long. And then secondly is, will there not always be some desire for the physical product, in the same way that not everybody uses their iPad or their Kindle for reading books? They still like the physical feel of a book in their hands, in the same way that people like opening up a newspaper, be it tabloid or be it broadsheet, and looking at the pages having been arranged for them professionally by somebody else, to almost to surprise them in some respects as to what's there, as well as giving them the items or the columnists or the writers that they expect. What do you think the future is for the physical newspaper?
It's very tricky, because I think there is without question, there is a tipping point where the printed product will become unviable from a cost perspective. That, you know, to even print one edition of the paper, you have to, or one copy of the paper, you have to have sub-editors, designers, it has to be legaled, it has to be laid out, it has to be printed on ink or printed on paper. The ink is very expensive, the paper is very expensive, it then needs to be delivered into, you know, to shops.
And after the distribution, the news agents need a cut, and the distributors need a cut.
And the difficulty is we're seeing more and more news agents stocking newspapers. You even see it around the centre of Dublin, which is, you know, breaks my heart, but again, you know, that's a trend.
They just don't want to give the space over to
Two things. It's becoming either prohibitively expensive for them, because, you know, or it's just too much hassle. Whereas, you know, when I was a kid and I was sent on the daily run to go down and get the milk, the bread and the papers. Papers were a huge draw into the shop. It was, you know, you get your paper and then you might get your cigarettes or you might get your whatever else. Now it's completely different, you know what I mean? So they think, you know, they're better off having milk or fizzy drinks on their shelves as opposed to having newspapers. To the wider question of how long newspapers last, I know Peter van der Mersch from Media House gave it 10 years. I would be a bit more forgiving than that.
You'd be more Murdoch than van der Mersch.
I would think so. I think, let me put it this way. I think you have to separate out the daily midweek market to the Sunday or the weekend market. The midweek market, I think, definitely is going to struggle because people want that bite-sized news. They want it quick. They want it fast. And yes, they clear all the indications here. They want it on their tablets. They want it on their mobile devices. There's less of a demand for that big read on a Wednesday or Thursday, except in exceptional circumstances, say, resignation of a Taoiseach, you know, natural disaster, COVID-19. There has been, and we've seen repeatedly, a kind of a drawback to traditional media because they want facts and they want accuracy and et cetera like that. Come to the weekend, people want that longer read. They want that immersive read. They want, like you say, to be challenged. They want to be provoked. They want to be entertained. And that's what a package like a printed newspaper or a printed news package can only give you. I think one of the struggles we have is how to lay out content online with that same degree of curation that you get in a printed product. So we're doing a web design redesign at the moment, and one of the big things I've asked for as much as we can is flexibility, that we can package stuff together properly to give it welly and show that we're committing to a story, but also to show that there's a logical chronology of stuff. One of the big difficulties we are asking ourselves on the daily basis, are we better off leaving our best story up on in our top slot for the entire day, or do we need to change it every couple of hours to give people the
sense concept of
or the sense of freshness? And sometimes it's the best story will stay there for the day because it's doing great numbers, and then other times you say, yeah, it's had its natural cycle, it's dead, it's not dead after 3 hours, but it's, you know, it's
so been, you're investigating the metrics of the popularity of every story,
almost minute by minute. We can say if Matt Cooper is a subscriber, we won't have your name in front of you, you know, but we can see how individual subscribers are engaging with our content, how often you're engaging with our content, how long you're engaging with our content, so we can there's average reading rates.
Anonymized,
of course.
Okay.
Yeah, but there'd be GDPR issues, Matt, I think, if I was knowing who was on. But yeah, no, it's anonymized, but it does show, you know, and one of the big things, whereas when I first iteration of a digital transformation in the Indo, it was about gross traffic numbers, and you know, we have a much more sophisticated metric now with subscriber engagement. So if you're a subscriber, again, we're more interested by how often you're coming back to us and how what's the level of engagement. So how long you're reading an article for, or how many articles are you bouncing from, say if you're in the app or you're going to the e-paper or going checking in online.
And does that influence then what goes into your print edition on Sunday?
Yes, but I think we do see a difference between what's on our online product and what's in the Sunday paper, because we do see the legacy and the valuable legacy of what the Business Post or the Sunday Business Post as it was before. You know, offered, you know, the likes of having you on the back page, having Marion McKeown, having Vincent Boland giving a world view, but then having the best in politics, having the best in kind of day-to-day news stories, you know, kind of, you know, what Killian Woods and Catherine Sands have been doing on the property and the legal sector of the last few months. That has proven a huge winner for us in terms of our subscribers. And, you know, property is a big one for us. There's a huge interest in our property coverage, not just commercial, but residential as well. And then there are certain things that, you know, would have surprised me. I would have thought would have had a bigger audience, but, you know, and these are the things that you're not downgrading, but worse things that we're looking at, you know, to do differently.
You mentioned the change of name from the Sunday Business Post to the Business Post. I was in the Sunday Business Post when it started, did the work in the weeks
and
before
I'll tell
the
you
launch
story.
In November.
The print, the plate of the front page of the first week is in our office and your name is there. And the story about Shane Ross.
It was. He had been thrown out of NCV Stockbrokers by Dermot Desmond. So I remember phoning him at that stage and getting the quotes for him for that particular story at the time. So that was November 1989. And then the Business Post, it was supposed to revolutionise business coverage, because up until then it had been a page a day in the Irish Times and the Irish Independent, very short pieces, more or less reprinting of press releases almost in many respects, with occasional breakout stories from that. But then everything has changed so much over the years. Business coverage expanded in the daily papers. And then you had one of your predecessors in the Business Post, Ian Keogh, going off and setting up the Currency.
Yeah.
And you have moved from the Sunday Business Post to the Business Post to provide effectively a 7-day service, which is something I presume you've had to do for audience numbers and for revenues, but does that also make it more difficult from a cost base and more difficult to protect your standalone Sunday newspaper?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a challenge to try and marry those two demands of trying to... So when I first came in, we were publishing anywhere between 4 and 6 maybe stories per day. We're now publishing on average anywhere between 25 and 45, depending on the day.
A subscriber is getting a full 7-day service from the business.
And that's what we're trying. So if you're a subscriber and ultimately if you're a corporate subscriber, you're the decision maker in a big corporate entity, our job is to try and convince you that you cannot live or you cannot work without the Business Post, because we'll be the only people to write quality analysis or quality reporting on what your company is doing, what your competitors are doing. And we're becoming much more specialized, much more niche in terms of like our areas of expertise. So, rehiring a banking correspondent, a markets correspondent, we're Daniel Murray being appointed as policy editor rather than a very subtle shift in terms of rather than a political correspondent or political editor. It was very much deliberately to make him a policy, because policy is where decisions are taken and it's the impact of that policy on businesses that we're looking at. We've done a huge amount of work of trying to understand what our audience is. And who are willing to pay money on a monthly basis, yearly basis to read the Business Post. And we've done a lot of work about finessing that content. And I suppose the hardest decisions I'm having with my colleagues on the news desk every day is, what are we not covering? What are the stories that we're not going to cover anymore that we would have maybe traditionally covered in the past? Stuff that isn't really within that business-to-business kind of mindset, and stuff that really we can say, if you want that story, you'll get it elsewhere. You won't get it. But what you will get from us is, focus on energy, focus on sustainability, focus on housing, on property, the best of politics, the best in policy. Markets coverage will be better than anywhere you'll get anywhere in Ireland. And you'll have the best in commentary and analysis from people like yourself and others.
You see, you're now not just talking like a journalist. You're talking like a marketeer.
Yeah.
You're talking like a business person. So what about the intellectual challenge and stimulation of that, but also the sheer volume of what is required out of an editor?
So the first point is the shift. So even when I was coming into the Business Post, I was classed as a political journalist because I had done that for so long. I had written, in my early days I'd written on everything from motoring to business to education to rich lists and all the rest of it. So like one of the great tricks that Angus Fanning had told me was to have an interest in lots of things, so you have to have a broad palette as an editor. I've definitely had to refine my wheelhouse. I've definitely had to really work on very hard to try and get up to speed in terms of like the ins and outs of business journalism. But like a good story is a good story. Like one of the first calls I made as editor was I wanted to prioritise two big entities in Ireland. One was the airport and one was RTE. We were very lucky in RTE. My first week, we had the Dave McRedmond story not being on the board. And that story just hasn't stopped. The airport, obviously, we were the first to be writing about the passenger cap. That has now become a mainstream story. So, and we're looking to give and set the agenda in those sort of sectors, and not just in those two areas that I've just mentioned, but across legal, in Catherine Sands, who's a brilliant legal affairs correspondent, Ellie Donnelly, who's leading on aviation, Killian Woods on property. All the way through, we're looking to kind of set the agenda. And to have the likes of Dominic McGrath in London and have Sarah Collins in Brussels will be transformative for us, because particularly Sarah in Brussels, she will get the first whiff of new legislation, new directives coming from the EU, which will be really important, because that's where Irish law is essentially written now. So to have someone like that, like Sarah, who's really vastly experienced on the ground in Brussels, will transform our offering. So yes, I'm having to think like an editor and think like a business editor as opposed to being a political. One of the hardest things I've had to do is almost forgo my natural political instincts in terms of what are we going with on the front page, or what are we, and sometimes politics will dominate, be it Leo Varadkar's departure, ins and outs of what has gone on within government and Simon Harris's kind of ascension to the crown. I mean, obviously it's been a big story for us. So that has required a change. But
beyond that, you also have to start thinking like a business person, because, and a marketeer, because you have a strategy that you have to, with others as well on the management side, but as the editor, you actually have to draw that up and implement it.
Totally. And one of the big transformation project we're doing, we call it a North Star. So we have a huge team internally working on this. We have subgroups working on, stuff like content, user engagement, our sales offering, employee engagement. So we have a whole network of team. We meet monthly, you know, the full North Star team, as we call it. We have a very in-depth, very intense process underway at the moment to try and refine our product. And my job is to drive that bus, is to empower the guys and girls I work with, to let them do their job, but drive the bus along. I report to a very dynamic chief executive in Sarah Murphy, who drives the bus very hard, and we work together in making sure that ship continues to go. It's not always easy because you're dealing with legacy cultures, you're dealing with, you know, obviously finite resources, you're dealing with kind of challenges that are unforeseen, you know, staff departures, all that kind of stuff, things that can happen and come in the way of progress. But, you know, the reason why I'm loving this job is that I'm completely out of my comfort zone. I could have stayed in Leinster House and been very happy and, you know, kept doing what I was doing, and I had achieved.
Since you're in your last year working, you were Journalist of the Year for the stories you broke.
Yeah, and that was definitely a milestone for me because, you know, it was recognition for, you know, a lot of years where I would have sat at that awards in the Mansion House thinking, shit, it should have been me, and I didn't, you know.
At least you're honest enough to admit that.
Well, like, I don't think it'd be honest not to, but I mean, it definitely marked. I remember finishing that budget. It was around the same time as the awards. I remember finishing the budget. And I said, I don't know if I can do this again. I don't know if I could do that process again. You know, I've done it for so long. And I had a very settled team in the Examiner, really good team. But I that itch for doing something else. And even, I tell you, Matt, like, I mean, I've stepped in for you as presenting on the last one a few times. And that opened up a whole different, it was a totally different skill set.
Yeah.
And I kind of said, well, is there something else? Like, is there something else? Mm. You know, and you always want to look at what's the next step? What is the next rung up the ladder or whatever like that? I was then approached to consider the Business Post position. I went through a process and thankfully, you know, I'm looking back and do I regret it? No. Has it been easy the last 15 months? No, but I wouldn't have expected it to be easy. It's been great, and I feel very energised by the work that we're doing. I see the progress that we have made, but it's every day is a real challenge. I
mean, clearly, you have a strategy, and you also have a backer in Bonnier, the Scandinavian company, who have had success in products like the Business Post in other parts of Europe and want to apply it to Ireland. But if you see a future for yourself as a hybrid newspaper come website, possibly website entirely at some stage in the future, what about all the other Irish newspapers? And this comes back to what I was asking you earlier about the competition from RT. Are they all going to survive?
We're well served in Ireland. We've got quite a lot of daily newspapers and a lot of
The size of
population that we have. Being realistic, will they all survive? I don't know. I think that's very much an open question. And I think, do we get to the point where the Irish Times and the Independent are publishing on alternate days during the week, so they're not in competition with each other? You know what I mean? Or do we see no printed products during the week at all, and it's all concentrated on the weekend?
No, there's some people who'd ask, does it matter? Because, you know, there's people who distrust what they describe as mainstream media, think it's too close to the powers that be, emphasised by things like we spoke of earlier about people moving from journalism into government and whatever. What do you think the need remains? Can it not be served by broadcasters or by social media?
I think, so broadcast is a very fast game. And you know yourself in terms of the news, like working in broadcast as a news reporter, you probably don't have the time, resources, space to really delve into investigative reporting and on a large scale, unless you are in RT and you're the investigations unit or there isn't, say, in the independent sector, there isn't that scope, or there generally isn't that kind of structure in place to do the sort of in-depth reporting. There will always be, in my view, I'm an optimist and I'm a firm believer that the appetite for news is there. Like, we're reading news much more in Ireland than we've ever done before.
Listening to it and watching it?
Consuming.
Isn't this the thing, particularly with younger generations? And I found that with this podcast and the other one that I do, Path to Power, that younger people are talking to me about it.
Yeah.
Whereas they would very rarely say anything about something, for example, that I've written. And yet, I would find there are times that when it comes to writing something that, and there's a particular piece I know I'll be doing for you for the Business Post for this Sunday, that is better suited to writing about because it'll take a major court report or a report published by the courts, going through it in detail, finding the information that's important, and by putting it in print will be easier, I think, to consume than anything that might be done in audio.
Yeah, and this is, I suppose, that's a very useful clarification for me to say how we consume, because we are constantly now on a daily basis. It's not just the written word. It's, you know, how we distribute or how do we promote our own content. Is it a visual? Does it need to be a short video for TikTok or for Instagram? Is it a podcast? Is it a, you know, is it audio visual, like in terms of, you know, myself and three of my colleagues sitting in a studio like this, you know, kind of talking through what's in the paper, you know, on a Saturday. You know, we're heading into a general election. We're heading into kind of autumn, you know, elections in the United States as well. So we're asking ourselves, what is the best way for us to share our content? Not just the written word, it's in every channel. I suppose we're trying to measure engagement of all of that, not just in terms of how many articles or how many clicks a particular article get. So if someone engages with a short video that I or a couple of my colleagues end up doing, that all counts towards an engagement metric, which is, you know,
but
shows
then to
the reach.
Use a horrible phrase. How do you monetize that?
I suppose if I can convince you, if you have a staff of 300 people, but you've an inner decision-making team of about 15 or 16 who are all, you know, with budgets and staff and all the rest of it, and my job is to convince you, or my team's job when they're going to, before you, is to say, well, listen, you need the business source code. We're going to write about you. We're going to not only write about you, we're going to be talking about you. We're going to do podcasts on you. And the only place you're going to get any sort of this content and get anywhere or access to that sort of analysis or detailed reporting is with us. But it's not just going to be the written word. It'll be an all. So your subscription will get you access to all of that suite of stuff. And if you don't, and if you log onto our website now, at your first click, you're asked your email address. That's a huge step forward from where we were. So you don't even get a free hit, you know, anymore. And then, you know, once you've registered, then there's a certain element of free content, and then you're followed up with emails. But by having your email address, we're able to kind of engage with you. Our newsletters are transformative in terms of how we reach an audience, because if you can send out an email, so we have a huge, people sign up to our newsletters, they can say, I'm interested in this content. It's generally the first step towards subscribing. That, you know, there's a certain large cohort of people who are willing to engage with you by way of a newsletter, who are your most fertile ground for getting subscribers in.
Something else I want to bring up, which is current, and this goes back. I mean, I'm a 20th century newspaper editor, that far ago, a little couple of years in the 21st century, but very much before the internet era. And one of the major issues that I would have had in my six and a bit years as editor of the Sunday Tribune were legal costs.
Yeah.
Because we have a situation in Ireland and continue to have a situation where the rich and the powerful can threaten newspapers with defamation actions, not necessarily because something written is incorrect, but because it can be difficult for the newspaper in a court to prove it. And there's an old phrase, you know, the greater the truth, the greater the libel. Or you get situations, which I've faced previously as well, where in one particular case where I was sued on the basis of something being entirely correct, but it was regarded as an invasion of privacy,
yeah,
even though it was 100% correct and was very much in the public interest. Now, that was one case that went away. So I'm continue to be fascinated by how difficult it is for newspaper editors to deal. How difficult has it been for you, the defamation laws in this country?
Yeah, it's been very difficult. And I've appeared before the Oireachtas Committee earlier this year on behalf of Newsbrands, which is our kind of industry body, to make the case ahead of the publication of the recent defamation laws. It's extraordinarily difficult because not only do we operate under, or have operated under, one of the most draconian libel systems in the world, in the Western world, most people don't realise if I get sued for libel, or if my newspaper gets sued for libel, the burden is on me, not on the person taking the case. So I have to, therefore, you know, to stack it up. Like, and that inherently weights it against us. The lack of a serious harms test for a judge to be able to apply to see whether or not to kind of knock out all the kind of vexatious, because there are vexatious claims that we get all the time. What we've seen an increasing trend, Matt, is almost preemptive legals that, you know, merely on the basis of queries going out to an individual or an institution, we'll get a legal letter in saying don't write about this.
That's always been the way.
Yeah. So it's been extraordinarily difficult.
But sorry, the quantum of harm is an interesting one, because that's not in the new legislation.
No, it's not.
That's been prepared.
And we see it as a mistake.
But there was an interesting recent case in relation to that, and it's your man from the west of Ireland, locked up because of the contempt case, Burke.
Yeah.
And Enoch Burke. And essentially, and this was a very dubious one, because although what the newspaper had written about him was untrue, it was basically decided by the judge, well, you actually don't have a leg to stand on because of other things, which wasn't necessarily a great template, was it, to set down, that a newspaper can get away with something on the basis it got it wrong and demonstrably wrong, but that it didn't matter because he had no reputation worth defending.
Yeah, but I think it's very hard to apply that across the board, Matt, because I think there were peculiarities to that individual case.
Oh, yes. So
I chose my words very carefully there. But I think there's merit in having a kind of a bar that it can be assessed as to whether or not it meets the threshold for a case, because going to court is extremely expensive.
Yeah.
And I think what you're seeing is, and as I made the case publicly before the Oireachtas, is, there is a chilling effect. You do, like, if you know that someone's going to come in heavy with a legal letter, it does make you second guess what you're doing. It does it make you gun shy? No, not necessarily, but doesn't give you.
But some people would argue that, well, if you get it right, you don't have to worry about it. But that's not necessarily the case, because you actually, as I was saying, the burden of proof falls on you to defend what you've written rather than the person who claims to be liable saying, no, this is why it's wrong.
So we see all these things in terms of the strategic libel letter, or slaps as they're called, in terms of people, basically trying to muzzle the press. As you say, people with big pockets can throw their muscle around. And we've seen it in the past in high notable people who were clearly up to no good, but given their sheer position and the depths of their pockets, or their institution's pockets as opposed to them, they were able to kind of muzzle the media and extract apologies out of various media organisations. So I think the new defamation laws are welcome. It certainly would help redress the balance. I don't think, for me, they don't go far enough. I think I would have liked to see the serious harms test in. I think the abolition of juries is a good thing. I do think it'll make things less complicated and less costly. I would think from an editor's perspective, I think a proper mediation process would go a long way to solving a lot. Like there really isn't any need for the amount of cases going to court. I think if you could get a mediation process, which would be far less costly, far more time efficient, and far more speedy, I think that would be to the benefit not only to the litigant or the complainant, but to the newspapers as well. Because the big danger for us, Matt, is that if someone comes in with a legal letter, if we've published on a Sunday or whenever we've published, and the cost is, well, do we roll the dice and go to court? That's a 300, 400 grand decision that I'm taking there and then. And a lot of newspapers in Ireland don't have insurance anymore. So it's not like it's a cost-free enterprise.
Sometimes the assumption is made is that all media organisations are wealthy and can afford to do this, which is actually not the case. Which brings me to one of my final questions. And again, for the sceptics out there and whatever, do you believe that Irish media in general does a good job in covering what is happening and does so without fear and favour?
I think Irish media, by and large, does an extremely good job. I think there
are we patting ourselves on the back now each
year? No, I think if you look favourably, I think we have, if you look at the UK market, we've largely resisted the sort of tribal ideological sort of bent that you see in the Telegraph, the Daily Mail versus the Guardian and whatever else. I think you get a very good service here from the media here. You might disagree with particular slants or individual kind of journalists that's democracy. Individual journalists have their own kind of pet projects or subjects. But I think the media does a very fine job within the context of the libel laws that we've just been discussing. I think, the muzzle that has been on Irish media for a long time has been counterproductive and has stopped media to a large degree being more robust where it could have or should have been. If you're going back several decades, could the media have been stronger in terms of calling out the Catholic Church earlier? Absolutely. Could it have been stronger? Is there an establishment bias in some elements of the media? There is in this country, and that's calling it straight. I think there has been, I think, not only RT, but I think some of the other mainstream newspapers have suffered from that establishment bias. We haven't given sufficient voice to either minorities or to people railing against the system. I have a huge respect for whistleblowers. I've written about them consistently through my career, because these are people who have generally tried to challenge the status quo and challenge kind of wrongdoing where they've seen it. I think the permanent government in this country exercise a huge amount of power, and for a large part they've seemed to be kind of off the pitch or not accountable, and I generally don't accept that given the power that they wield behind the scenes, but I do think by and large the media under extreme pressure in terms of costs, you know, their cost pressures and dwindling resources. I think they do an extremely good job. Could it be improved? Yes, it could. But I think any fair analysis and objective analysis would say that, you know, we generally don't, I've no inkling of wanting to be a lickspittle for a government or trying to get my belly tickled by a government minister. And I certainly think none of my reporters do either. But I think there are others possibly who are you know, that's the way they want to do their business. But I think you'll certainly find in this Sunday's Business Post and online every day a very robust challenging of the status quo.
Great way to finish. Thank you very much. Daniel McConnell, editor of the Business Post, for being with us. That's it for today's Magnified, and indeed that's it for this particular series. But there are loads of other interviews from the series that you can go back and listen to and hopefully very much enjoy. If you've liked this, recommend it please to a friend wherever it is you're listening to it, be it Apple, Spotify or on the Go Loud app. And thanks again to our sponsors for this series, Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. If you're looking to upgrade your business fleet, well, choose from a wide range of vehicles local to you by visiting vwfs.ie/business. Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. And hopefully in time we'll be back with another series of Magnified with Matt Cooper for you. But as I said, there are three series there for you to go back and enjoy if you want to, and I hope very much that you do. Thank you very much for listening.
Go Loud presents Magnified with Matt Cooper, proudly sponsored by Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Move your business forward with a fleet of commercial or passenger vehicles. Build your fleet to your expectations. Visit vwfs.ie/business.
Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Go Loud. Sounds better with us.